This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. and Canadian officials cite intelligence they say indicates an Iranian missile was responsible for the deadly crash of a Ukrainian jetliner Tuesday shortly after it took off from a Tehran airport. VOA's Lattice Ahok.
Nearly half of the passengers on board were Iranian citizens, and many were Canadians. Asked if the United States could be blamed for provoking an action that killed 176 people, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said no conclusions should be made before a complete investigation determines why the plane crashed.
I think it is too soon to be drawing conclusions or assigning blame or responsibility in whatever proportions. Right now, our focus is on supporting the families that are grieving right across the country and providing what answers we can in a preliminary way, but recognizing that there is going to need to be a full and credible investigation into what exactly happened before we draw any conclusions.
Officials in Tehran on Thursday denied that the plane had been hit by a missile. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. House has passed a non-binding measure aimed at limiting President Donald Trump's ability to take military action against Iran.
The aim is to criticize the U.S. killing of Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani. North Carolina Republican Mark Meadows says it amounts to apologizing to Iran for an action that was justified.
All this does is emboldens our enemies to suggest that the American people are divided. But I'm here to tell you that we are not divided.
Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro says facts are being obscured.
The administration could not provide any specifics about what constituted an imminent threat. They couldn't tell us what the targets were.
President Trump did not consult with congressional leaders ahead of the attack. Ed Donahue, Washington.
More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. President Trump Thursday celebrated the killing of Iran's Quds Force commander and mocked Democrats for wanting advance notice of military operations. Speaking in Toledo, Ohio, in his first campaign rally since the fatal drone strike he ordered against the Iranian Quds Force commander, Mr. Trump said that he took bold and decisive action to save American lives. He also mocked the Democrats for criticizing the decision. And those who wanted a heads-up call to Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
We got a call. We heard where he was. We knew the way he was getting there. And we had to make a decision. We didn't have time to call up Nancy, who was not operating with a full deck.
His comments came after Democratic-controlled House on Thursday approved the resolution asserting that Mr. Trump must seek approval from Congress before engaging in further military action against Iran. Australian authorities urged nearly a quarter of a million people to evacuate their homes Friday as soaring temperatures and erratic winds were expected to fan deadly bushfires across the east coast. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian said that at a briefing Friday that high winds and high temperatures make for dangerous conditions.
When you've got such high temperatures and unpredictable wind conditions, you have to brace yourself for new emergencies or new contingencies, and that's why across those risk areas we have in excess of 30 strike teams ready to move into an area if an unexpected fire breaks.
More than 150 fires remain alight across the country, and authorities fear a southerly shift in winds due later in the day will fan the flames and change the direction of many of the fires. Temperatures are expected to shoot well above 40 degrees Celsius in several parts of Australia Friday, threatening to inflame a bushfire season that's already destroyed nearly 2,000 homes. Federal prosecutors say jailhouse video no longer exists of the area around Jeffrey Epstein's jail cell on the day he survived an apparent suicide attempt. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan told a judge Thursday that jail officials preserved video of the wrong jail cell and that the backup system also failed to capture footage because of technical issues. An Epstein attorney says the missing video deepens the mystery surrounding his suicide weeks later. An attorney for Epstein's former cellmate has requested a court hearing to determine what happened to the missing video. On streets of find more at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 10th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's Bobi Wine reschedules consultations following meetings with police and elections commission.
This time, Uganda police promised to observe the law and not to behave in an illegal manner. So right now, ladies and gentlemen, as we speak, we are going back to reschedule all our consultations, which I must guarantee to you will all happen.
Botswana's main opposition says it has abundant evidence that the October 23 elections was fraudulent. Zimbabwe's vice president deploys the army to prevent his estranged wife from accessing their matrimonial home. And South Sudan's first vice president criticizes the United States for imposing sanctions on him.
Despite the sanctions strongly imposed on him, His Excellency General Taban Dengai pledges to continue to work with the United States and the international community to prove the unfounded nature of the allegations against him.
Andy Sandria is the office manager for First Vice President Taban Dengai. Those stories for Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda presidential hopeful Robert Chakulayi, also known as Bobi Wine, has met with the Electoral Commission seeking to rein in the police after they allegedly blocked Bobi Wine's legal consultations about his candidacy in the 2021 election. Wine, who has canceled three such meetings due to police intervention, says he will draw up a new schedule for the consultations after talking with the Electoral Commission on Thursday. Viewers Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The Electoral Commission meeting with Bobi Wine and a number of senior police officers was aimed at reaching consensus on how Wine can carry on his consultations without police interference. Wine has so far failed to hold three of his scheduled meetings after police used sections of the Public Order Management Act to disperse his supporters and cordon off his meeting venues. Police claimed, among other reasons, that they did not receive notification in writing from Bobi Wine on time. Thursday's meeting resolved that police officers should receive and acknowledge written applications from Wine's group and also write back in time before the meeting. Joel Senyanyi is the spokesperson of Wine's pressure group, People Power.
We have agreed that whenever we write to police, for starters, they should receive our letters, because in some of the places when we wrote to them, some DPCs said they will not receive these letters, others received, but they refused to acknowledge receipt by signing or stamping, and so we have agreed, and police conceded that this is wrong. And so they are going to be ordering all their commanders across the country pretty much that when we write to them, they should, for starters, acknowledge receipt of these letters, because these are official letters. So acknowledge receipt, sign and stamp. And after that process, then police writes back to us.
He says there was agreement at the meeting that some of the requirements listed by the police are ridiculous.
Bring firefighting trucks, bring sniffer dogs, they're about to ask us to bring oxygen cylinders for our participants. And the EC has conceded that these are unreasonable. And so there was consensus in the room that these unreasonable demands should not happen again.
Jotham Talemwa is Electoral Commission spokesperson. He told Wine's group to stick to consultations in a closed venue as agreed upon in the meeting.
Because you are allowed to consult, why don't you limit your activities to consulting? Why do you want to hinge on that and use it as a campaign strategy when you were or not under the law? Campaigns are provided for, and for people who have been successfully nominated.
Wine, who sounded optimistic after the meeting, said he and his aides are anticipating a smooth run for the new schedule for the consultations.
This time, Uganda police promised to observe the law and not to behave in an illegal manner. Also, the Electoral Commission promised to follow this matter very closely, because that's their responsibility. So right now, ladies and gentlemen, as we speak, we are going back to the rescheduling board to reschedule all our consultations, which I must guarantee to you will all happen. It is the Electoral Commission that is on trial to see that it is independent and it is impartial.
With the number of Ugandans, especially young people, embracing Wine's People Power movement, the legislator has been viewed as a big threat to President Yoweri Museveni and his government. Wine, a popular musician, also has been forced to cancel a number of concerts. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The lead attorney for Botswana's main opposition, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, the UDC party, says the group has compelling evidence that the recent general election was neither transparent nor credible. Dick Bayford says he remains confident about the prospects of the UDC's legal challenge to the outcome of the October 23rd elections. This comes after the country's Chief Justice said President Mongwitsi Masisi won a five-year term with the governing Botswana Democratic Party winning 29 seats in the National Assembly. Lead attorney Dick Bayford tells viewers Peter Clotty that the opposition has persuasive evidence to prove its case that the elections were not credible.
One of the considerations that the court would take into account to determine whether a case should be adjudged expeditiously is whether that litigant, the appellant, has got reasonable prospects of success. Now, in this particular case, the judge of the Court of Appeal made that finding that the UDC enjoys reasonable prospects of success. And it is hardly surprising because all the election petition, which comprised a challenge of about 15 constituencies in Botswana, they were determined by a panel of three High Court judges, out of which two found against the UDC and one found in favor of the UDC. That is indicative of the fact that the UDC, in fact, does enjoy reasonable prospects of success on appeal.
This is what a lot of people, Motswana as they call him, have been asking, whether the UDC, and being their lead attorney, has compelling evidence to prove beyond any shadow of doubt that there were voter irregularities or perhaps rigging during the recent general election. Do you have that compelling evidence to prove your case?
Yes, we believe that we have that compelling evidence. We have evidence from several whistleblowers from the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, whose evidence, and they've given this evidence under oath. We do have sworn statements from these individuals who say that they were part and parcel of a conspiracy taken at the highest level of the Botswana Democratic Party to rig these elections. And also participating in the conspiracy, so they say, was the Director General of Intelligence and Security Services. And a lot of money was put into the scheme. It entailed having to, you know, bribe voters' registration officers around the country. It entailed a massive trafficking of voters and a lot of other things, you know, which clearly point out to a fraud having been perpetrated for the ruling party to win these elections.
What do you say to critics who are saying that this is just a mere publicity stunt which will tarnish the reputation of Botswana as having strong democratic credentials?
No, it's not a publicity stunt because the UDC is not making baseless or empty allegations. We have presented these affidavits from these whistleblowers to court. They've been taken under oath. And in fact, a forensic examiner in South Africa had occasion to speak to these whistleblowers and prepared a report. So it's not as if we are dealing directly with these whistleblowers. What happened is that the whistleblowers left the country because they feared for their life. They then met a forensic examiner, and they told him, they narrated to him the entire story. And we had this information about vote rigging through this report, which had been compiled by a forensic examiner, a very, very professional forensic examiner in South Africa.
Dick Bayford is the lead attorney for Botswana's main opposition party, the Umbrella for Democratic Change. He spoke with U.S. Peter Clotty from the capital, Habaruni. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 10th. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Deng Gai, has criticized the United States for imposing sanctions on him. The U.S. Treasury Department announced Wednesday that it was sanctioning Taban Deng Gai for his role in the kidnapping and killing of two prominent South Sudanese, as well as other serious human rights abuses. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
The U.S. government accuses Taban Deng Gai of working to divide and sow distrust within opposition opponents and the broader Nuer community, which the U.S. says has extended the conflict in South Sudan and deteriorated the peace process. The first vice president's office manager, Andel Sandrai, also calls the sanctions regrettable.
The U.S. Department of the Treasury Office of the Foreign Asset Control sanctions a high-profile individual of the caliber of His Excellency, General Tabandengai, on baseless, unfounded allegations and wrongly accuses the first vice president of serious human rights abuses.
The U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control says Deng arranged and directed the disappearance and killings of human rights lawyer Samuel Dong Luak and SPLM-IO member Agri Idri, who were kidnapped in Nairobi in 2017 and later turned up in a Juba prison. Sandrai disputes that allegation when it comes to Deng.
In discharging his duties as the first vice president of the Republic of South Sudan, he dedicated and committed himself to working for the unity and peaceful coexistence among the people of South Sudan to secure a future for them.
The U.S. says its latest sanctions fall under the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act, which targeted perpetrators of serious human rights abuse and corruption. The U.S. called on all nations to exclude all individuals from the international financial system who jeopardize South Sudan's future. The parties to the revitalized peace agreement are supposed to form a unity government next month after two extensions to the pre-transitional period. The U.S. Treasury Department says its government will not hesitate to target those who have perpetrated the conflict in South Sudan and will continue to apply pressure on the senior leadership of the country to take concrete measures to bring peace and stability to South Sudan. Sandrai insists Deng is working to restore peace in his country.
Despite the sanctions strongly imposed on him, His Excellency General Tabandengai pledges to continue to work with the United States and the international community to demonstrate such commitment and to prove the unfounded nature of the allegations against him.
The sanctions freeze all cash or assets held in the U.S. territory and block access to the American financial system connected to Deng. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wundu in Juba.
Zimbabwe's Vice President Constantino Chiwenga has allegedly deployed the army to barricade his matrimonial home and other properties to prevent his estranged wife, Mary Mubewa, from accessing her children and properties. Mubewa's lawyer, Taona Nyamankura, confirmed the development, saying his client was denied entry to the matrimonial home. Mubewa was granted bail this week and ordered by a court to live at the matrimonial mansion in Harare. Chiwenga's lawyer, Wilson Manasse, was not immediately available for comment. Human rights lawyer Diwa Mavinga tells viewers Zimbabwe Service Blessing Zulu that the acting president's actions are unconstitutional and an abuse of state institutions and the army.
I think with all due respect, the acting president general, Constantino Chiwenga, is out of order. It is abuse of institutions and of the army to use the army to bar his estranged wife from accessing her home in compliance with an existing court order. What needs to happen now, and which is an appeal to General Chiwenga, is to respect the rule of law. When the law is made a pronouncement, it must be respected. If General Chiwenga is aggrieved or is unhappy with the ruling of the court, he should not resort to the army to have his way. He must equally approach the courts, use the legal procedures set out within the framework of the rule of law to appeal the ruling and have it overturned by the courts, and not to ignore or seek or purport individually to set aside a court ruling and act outside the framework of the rule of law. This is not good for himself and for the image of the country of Zimbabwe.
But General Chiwenga is alleging that his estranged wife wanted to murder him. Does he not have a legal leg to stand on to say that she cannot access the matrimonial home?
Well, those are allegations by General Chiwenga, and I am sure the court was seized with that information. But when the court has made a ruling, Mary Chiwenga is still the wife of General Constantino Chiwenga at law. So the court has made a pronouncement. General Chiwenga cannot take the law into his own hands. If he has got a view that perhaps there was an attempt on his life, that is for the courts to decide. And the court has made a decision. And if he is unhappy with that existing decision, General Chiwenga should approach a higher court in a form of an appeal against this ruling, and not to use the army to disregard the rule of law, to disregard a court ruling, and to violate the rights of Mary Chiwenga. He's a strange wife with whom they have children together. And Mary Chiwenga should have access to these children and to her property within this matrimonial home as per court ruling. And the appeal is clear that this is simply a matter of respecting the rule of law. And this is what General Chiwenga, the acting president of Zimbabwe, should do to lead by example so that it can be seen that there is respect for the rule of law in Zimbabwe.
Lastly, Mr. Mavinga, it's not the first time that General Chiwenga has allegedly used the army to deal with a domestic matter. Similar allegations were leveled against him by his former wife, Jocelyn Chiwenga. Why is this continuing?
I think it's unfortunate. It's a case of abuse of power. But my appeal to General Chiwenga is this, to say, General, try and use traditional methods and mechanisms as well in terms of the two families. The in-laws should come together and discuss and resolve amicably these matters within the framework of respecting the rule of law.
Diwa Mavinga is a human rights lawyer. He spoke with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service. A dozen people were injured in protests in Guinea earlier this week as residents took to the streets to contest both a potential third-term bid in the 2020 elections from current President Alpha Conde, as well as a teacher strike in other regions. Francois Patuel, a West Africa researcher for Amnesty International, spoke to Ricky Shryak about ongoing tensions in Guinea and the West Africa region as a whole over 2020 elections.
But the protests have been mostly peaceful, particularly compared to protests in the late 2019. So the protests yesterday were mostly peaceful. There were some violence, particularly in Labé. But the protests were a bit different. They were also about a teacher's strike in Labé.
So it's kind of multiple protests going on at once.
Yes.
What is the status of Alpha Conde's potential bid for a third term, and what kind of support and then what kind of opposition is he facing in the country in regards to that?
Well, he still hasn't announced clearly what his line of action will be. For the moment, he's just suggesting to change the constitution. He still hasn't announced that he will be a candidate. Many in the Guinean civil society fear that he will try to run for third term once he gets the constitutional change through. But, you know, so far this is just speculation. He still hasn't made his stance clear. And the fact that there is such unclarity is one of the things that fuels the political tensions in Guinea. And there's been many protests at the end of 2019, which has resulted in at least 17 deaths since October 2019, but also the arrest of some of the pro-democracy leaders of the FNDC, the Front National pour la Défense de la Constitution, which in English is the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution.
There are civil societies who do not want a constitutional change, but does Conde have support among other Guineans, perhaps?
Well, that's very difficult to establish, and one of the reasons for that is that it's, for the moment, there isn't that sort of space which would enable a fair and a transparent and an open process for discussing the constitutional changes.
And is to put it in some regional context, because of course Guinea's neighbor as well, Ivory Coast, the president there, Alassane Ouattara, is discussing whether he might run for a third term or not. How does that affect regional stability as well? Is it worrisome about regional stability?
Yes, it's extremely worrying. It's Guinea who's going to have elections in 2020. It's also Ivory Coast. It's also Togo. So, you know, these are quite tense political environments. And sadly, in the region, periods of elections are often periods of political tensions and periods where there is crackdown on dissent and where there are human rights violations against people who express dissent. We've seen also what has happened in Benin, for instance, earlier also in 2019, where people were arrested and some people were killed in demonstrations in relation to legislative elections.
That was Francois Patouel, a West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar, Senegal. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with news that Kenya's female volleyball team, the Malkia Strikers, have qualified for the 2020 Volleyball Olympics to be held in Tokyo, Japan in July. The national ladies volleyball team beat Nigeria in three sets, 25-15, 25-21, and 25-12, making it to the tournament. Kenya now has three team sports at the Olympics, as Malkia Strikers will now join the Rugby 7 men and women's teams. Staying with the East African country, the participation of Kenya swimmers in the 2020 Tokyo Olympics is hanging in the balance after the International Swimming Federation, FINA, suspended the Kenya Swimming Federation until they hold elections. The Kenya Swimming Federation last held elections in September 2014, but despite constant notices by FINA, they have failed to hold elections, prompting the World Swimming Governing Body to act. According to the FINA Rule C-828, all members are obliged to hold the General Assembly at least every 2 years. The General Assembly must approve the accounts, the budget, a technical report, as well as an audited report. Elections must also take place every 4 years. But it appears the Kenya Swimming Federation seem to be in default of most of these rules. In the meantime, the Rwandan national women's beach volleyball teams will be looking to emulate recent heroics of their male counterparts when the Sub-Zone 5 qualifiers for the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games get underway in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, later today. In the men's category, Rwanda advanced to the second round earlier this week after finishing top of Sub-Zone 6 in Eritrea, following effortless victories over Egypt, Eritrea, and South Sudan. Rwanda's two female teams will know who they will face in their first matches after the technical meeting on Friday morning. And to West Africa, where the Nigerian Football Federation has confirmed its interest in hosting the 2020 Women's African Cup of Nations. The Super Falcons have won the tournament as host on three previous occasions in 1998, 2002, and 2016, and are also the current holders, having claimed an 11th title overall in 2018. The Confederation of African Football President Ahmed Ahmed told the French radio station RFI that Equatorial Guinea are also interested in hosting the event. CAF is in the race to find a host for the finals after Congo Brazzaville pulled out of the hosting of the 12-team event last year. And finally, Zamalek will host ZESCO United in the CAF Champions League Group A match on Friday. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sport. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that is it for this Friday, January 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botte, wishing you a very good weekend.
The 62nd Annual Grammy Awards Show is coming up. To celebrate, Border Crossings will play songs from the winners of the 2019 American Music Awards to refresh you on some of last year's best tracks. Tune in to hear from your favorite artists like Post Malone, BTS, and Taylor Swift, January 23rd on The Voice of America.
VOA.
ways, Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation. Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.